From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, the 13th of May, 2009. As the debate over harsh interrogation techniques continues, a former FBI interrogator testifies the methods simply don't work.
Waiting 180 hours as part of a sleep deprivation stage is time we cannot afford to waste in a ticking bomb scenario.
San Francisco residents are at odds over a school board decision to reinstate the junior ROTC.
I want to tell you what this will mean. It means you are welcoming an institution, the military, into our schools, an institution responsible for killing civilians in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan.
And we'll go to India, where a month-long voting process may mean that three parties will have to learn to share power. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for those stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Sri Lanka today, a second mortar attack on a makeshift hospital killed at least 50 civilians living in the war zone. FSRN's Ponia Manikavasagam has the story.
Tamil Tiger rebels cornered in a tiny patch of coastal land blamed government forces for the attack and the civilian deaths. But the army says this is false propaganda. A volunteer in the hospital, who requested to remain anonymous, says they were hit by two or three shells. She says the situation is terrible.
Because of the shelling in the morning and the rounds as well, people are really afraid to stay in the hospital. I think the fighting is taking place 500 meters away.
The International Red Cross says one of its aid workers also died along with his mother in shelling near the hospital. A spokesperson for the Red Cross says, for the second day, they have had to abandon attempts to evacuate the injured and the sick from the hospital. Ponnaiya Manikavasagam, FSRN, Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Fighting continues in Pakistan today as the head of the country's army told his troops to focus on keeping civilian casualties at a minimum, quote, even at the expense of taking risks, according to a statement from the military. In Peshawar today, Taliban fighters raided a NATO depot and burned eight trucks. It's estimated that now 800,000 civilians in the conflict zone have fled their homes. Today, four Mexican guest workers filed suit against an Arkansas farm owner over labor trafficking and other abuses. Malcolm Glover in Little Rock, Arkansas, has the details.
The federal lawsuit alleges that Jack Odom of Odom Farms in Austin, Arkansas, brought the guest workers to the U.S., forced them to live in deplorable conditions, and failed to pay them the minimum guest worker rate required by the U.S. government. Sarah Donaldson with Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid is working with Southern Migrant Legal Services as an attorney for the guest workers. Donaldson says the workers lived and worked in a hot metal shed. They weren't allowed to leave the farm without an escort, and after confiscating their passports, the grower threatened to report them to immigration.
This case also outlines a bigger problem with the guest worker program. You know, unlike U.S. workers, you know, who have the option of just changing jobs when they're exploited by an employer, guest workers are tied to particular employers. That's what their visa says. Their visa doesn't allow them to work for other employers. And a lot of employers take advantage of that.
Donaldson says the case may go to trial within a year. Odom Farms would not return calls for comment. Malcolm Glover, FSRN, Little Rock.
House Democrats say they are close to reaching a compromise on a bill to cut greenhouse gas emissions. The bill would set up a cap-and-trade system for industries and set renewable power and energy efficiency targets for states. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
Last night, House Democrats on the Energy and Commerce Committee announced a breakthrough in negotiations over the proposed emissions bill. The bill has faced some opposition from states that rely on coal and heavy industry, but now reported changes may make its passage onto the House floor possible. The compromise bill is weaker. Among the reported concessions is a relaxing of renewable energy requirements for states. The bill originally called for all states to get 25% of their electricity from renewable power by the year 2025. The new version of the bill would lower the standard to 15%. Also underway are negotiations over allotment of pollution credits to industries under the proposed cap-and-trade system, which the Obama administration has strongly supported. Environmental advocates say the reported compromises are a small setback in the fight to pass climate change legislation. Liz Pereira is with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
We need need this. We need to move forward, and we need, more importantly, we need to give Obama's negotiators something to walk into the Copenhagen meetings by the end of this year. The only direction is forward, and we need to do it any way we can.
President Obama is set to visit key international climate talks in Copenhagen this December. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Following a sea change in U.S. policy towards the U.N. under the Obama administration, a delegate from the U.S. is now a sitting member on the United Nations Human Rights Council. Ambassador Susan Rice will serve a 3-year term on the 18-nation council following elections yesterday.
We're gratified by the strong showing of encouragement for the United States to again play a meaningful leadership role in multilateral organizations, including the U.N., on the very vitally important set of issues relating to human rights and democracy.
The Bush administration formally boycotted the council, partly because of its criticism of Israel's treatment of Palestinians. Now the Obama administration says it wants to reform and strengthen the council from within. The U.S. took New Zealand's place on the Human Rights Council. China, Russia, Cuba, and Saudi Arabia are represented as well. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
President Obama has decided against releasing photos of detainee abuse in Iraq and Afghanistan. The administration said the pictures released could harm troops in the field. The Pentagon was set to make the photographs public at the end of this month due to a Freedom of Information Act request filed by the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU decried the decision. In recent weeks, former Vice President Dick Cheney has been defending the use of harsh interrogation techniques, saying they elicited important information. But former FBI interrogator Ali Soufan painted a different picture. He says intense interrogation methods of Abu Zubaydah, a suspected member of al-Qaeda, were ineffective.
The contractors had to keep requesting authorization to use harsher and harsher methods. In the case of Abu Zubaydah, that continued for several months, right till waterboarding was introduced. And waterboarding itself had to be used 83 times, an indication that Abu Zubaydah had already called his interrogators bluff.
Ali Soufan's face could not be shown to the media to protect his identity. Partitioned on the side of the hearing room, Soufan said harsh interrogation techniques are not only unreliable, but slow.
Waiting 180 hours as part of a sleep deprivation stage is time we cannot afford to waste in a ticking bomb scenario.
Soufan says using wit and intelligence are the most effective methods.
In contrast, when we interrogated him, using intelligent interrogation methods, within the first hour, we gained important actionable intelligence.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina challenged Soufan's assertion.
Do you believe that any good information was obtained through harsh interrogation techniques? Can you say that there was no good information?
Well, from what I know on the Abu Zubaydah, I would like you to evaluate the information that we got before.
Well, the vice president suggesting that there was good information obtained. And I'd like the committee to get that information. Let's have both sides of the story here. I mean, one of the reasons these techniques have survived for about 500 years is apparently they work.
Also testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee was Philip Zelikow. He worked for the 9/11 Commission and then for the State Department. He was an internal critic of the legal justifications for waterboarding and other interrogation methods. But Bush administration officials ignored a lengthy memo he wrote.
I heard the memo was not considered appropriate for further discussion and that copies of my memo should be collected and destroyed.
Zelikow says the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department dismissed a measure passed by Congress known as the McCain Amendment, which defines the framework for interrogations. Meanwhile, a report released last week by Human Rights First says 100 detainees have died in U.S. custody, possibly as a result of harsh interrogations. Devin Chafee is Advocacy Counsel for Human Rights First.
What the findings of the report showed were that there were a number of deaths in custodies that were not properly explained or properly investigated. And what the report called for was stronger investigations and more thorough accountability for prisoner abuse.
While Congress will likely continue to hold public hearings, the Senate Intelligence Committee is conducting an investigation using both classified and declassified information to piece together the puzzle of the Bush administration's policy on torture. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
In Maine, members of the Sudanese immigrant community say their basic safety is threatened. The Sudanese Community Association is calling for an immediate meeting with the governor and attorney general. They're also demanding justice in the case of David Okot. Just last month, Portland police shot and killed Okot, who they say brandished a firearm after officers approached him. However, family members don't buy the story that he ever displayed a weapon and are critical that the officers dragged his body down a flight of stairs and down a street after he was shot. This police shooting is the latest in a decade's worth of sometimes dubious altercations between local police and members of Portland's Sudanese immigrant community. I'm joined on the line by Dan Lilly. He represents Mr. Okot's estate. Dan, you're conducting an investigation into what happened to David Okot. What can you tell us that you've found so far?
Well, I can't get into all the specifics, but I'm not going to mention names. I don't think it's appropriate in this state. But we have two witnesses who claim to have seen the shooting from across the street, a vantage point being at a building across the street where they reside. And they both are claiming that there was no gun drawn by Mr. Okot, and they saw no weapon at all, and that he had put his hands outstretched when the police saw two police cruisers arrived, and that the officers commenced firing and fired multiple shots. How many is uncertain, but at least five or six apparently entered Mr. Okot's body, his head mostly area, and the rest were fired and are visible on the dwelling that he was on the porch of. So that's essentially what we know now, and there's some spin-off facts from that we're checking out that I just don't have any information of. I'd rather not discuss at the moment until I talk to my investigator about what's going on at the present.
How have authorities responded?
Well, it's difficult for me to say. I mean, the Attorney General's office investigates these cases automatically. Previous Attorney General, however, investigated some 70 shootings where deadly force was used by various police officers in the state and has never found any of them to be unreasonable. So they got a clean bill of health on all of those over a span of time of close to 10 years. But we have a new Attorney General who just came aboard, Janet Mills, a first female Attorney General we've ever had in our state, and she is making sounds, at least, that she is going to look at these things a little more critically, and that she's going to perhaps use a different standard than the previous Attorney General. So the community is cautiously optimistic that that kind of investigation may bear fruit.
The Sudanese community has sent a letter to Maine's governor and the attorney general. The letter says that they want justice. What does justice look like in a situation like this?
Boy, that's a big question. I think people have been struggling with that for centuries. In the context of this, I would guess, and we certainly intend to pursue claims of liability and damages, which we, I guess, would call justice if, in fact, we can prove our case. So at least from my piece of this, in our office's piece of this, with my investigator, should we find that, in fact, no gun was visible or no gun was attempted to be used as deadly force against the police, then we would file a lawsuit with some civil rights causes of action in it. And we would view justice, I guess, as winning that lawsuit and getting these people some compensation, more importantly, some responsibility defined by a jury that the police had gone too far.
Dan, thanks for joining us today.
All right. Good luck.
Dan Lilly is the attorney representing David Okot's estate.
Come and see, oh, what's done happened to me.
San Francisco's school board voted Tuesday to restore the junior ROTC program to city schools. The Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps is a high school program sponsored by the U.S. Armed Forces. The military says it encourages patriotism, leadership, and physical fitness for youth. But critics say JROTC programs are a way for the Pentagon to recruit children and promote militarism. As Africa Jones reports, the program has sharply divided San Francisco's residents.
The slim 4-3 vote on a proposal to save JROTC in San Francisco came only a month before the program was supposed to end. Emotions ran high on both sides as students and residents spoke for and against the proposal.
My name is Mara Kubrin, and I'm a graduate of Lowell High School, and during my senior year, the school board decided to vote to phase out JROTC. 2 years later, the same issue is back at the school board, and I hope that we take care of it once and for all. Please get the military out of our schools.
San Francisco's junior ROTC program has been around for 90 years, but in 2006, the board voted to phase out the program over concerns of military recruiters in schools. Since then, the number of San Francisco students enrolled in JROTC has dropped from 1,600 students to 500. Opponents of JROTC say that the program promotes militarism and targets minorities for recruiting.
My name's Carol Seligman. I want to tell you what this will mean. It means you are welcoming an institution, the military, into our schools, an institution responsible for killing civilians in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. It means you are contradicting every effort to teach nonviolent solutions to problems our youth encounter, as you welcome, in the words of Martin Luther King Jr., the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, into our schools.
Last November, San Francisco voters passed a non-binding resolution in support of JROTC. Proponents of JROTC say the program is less about the military and more about leadership. Andrew Oh, a senior and battalion commander at Washington High School, says the program is misunderstood.
Well, I have gained a lot of confidence throughout the 4 years. Our instructors never tell us to join any military or anything like that. And I am going to UC Davis this incoming school year. So I think my goal is college instead of military.
At the meeting, high school students in support of JROTC vastly outnumbered those against. At one point, Reverend Amos Brown, head of the city's NAACP chapter, began to argue with board member Hydra Mendoza.
I will not sit down because you will not fair.
1 minute. Everybody's had 1 minute. Can we please
spare the students? You gave the opposition 2 minutes.
Please let the kids have an opportunity to share with us.
You gave the opposition two minutes. You know you did.
We know, but you've been talking.
No, you didn't.
Everybody's going to go off.
The chair cleared the room. Brown, who supports the JROTC, says the board meeting was unfair.
People came here to speak, and she's going to stack the deck by presenting the opposition first. And then the people who came here in large numbers to speak, going to cut that time.
When the meeting resumed, student Jesse Pinta spoke in favor of the bill.
We don't learn how to kill people. I've been taught how to save lives. I saved an 80-year-old man who was bleeding on the street and had to perform first aid.
Another reason the board voted to phase out junior ROTC 3 years ago was because of the military's don't ask, don't tell policy against gays and lesbians. Board Vice President Jane Kim said it's a civil rights matter.
Now, I understand that we do not discriminate students in JROTC, but that doesn't take away from the fact that to even become an instructor, you have to go through the military. And it doesn't take away from the fact that if a student does choose to join the military after this program and they are openly LGBT, they cannot come out and identify themselves.
But the board's student delegate, Maxwell Wallace, who is gay, says he supports the proposal.
I definitely came around and definitely became a supporter of this program because I think it serves our students so well, specifically gay students.
In the end, the board passed the proposal in support of junior ROTC with an amendment urging enrollees to act to change the military's don't ask, don't tell policy. But the fight over JROTC in San Francisco is not over. Opponents say a technicality over whether junior ROTC counts as a physical education credit could help stop the city's program. The San Francisco School Board is expected to take up that issue sometime this summer. Africa Jones, FSRN.
After a marathon month-long voting process, India's national elections ended Wednesday. The main contest in this keenly fought political battle was between three alliances led by the ruling Congress Party, the opposition BJP, and the left. Results won't be known until Saturday, but political bargaining has already started, with the three alliances seeking allies to form the government at the center. Bismila Gilani has the story.
India's election commissioners say they are relieved that the largest event management project in the world has come to an end. More than 8,000 candidates were in the fray for 543 parliamentary constituencies in these elections. Despite elaborate security arrangements, the month-long polling process was marred by violence, with attacks by Maoist rebels leaving more than 35 people dead. A close contest between three political alliances turned this election into the most bitterly fought in the recent times. Although issues like internal security and infrastructure development dominated the political scene in the initial days of the campaign, it soon turned ugly, with most politicians launching personal attack against one another. Many analysts say this contributed to low turnout. Only half of the 714 million eligible voters went to the polls. V.V. Singh is a researcher at the Center for the Study of Developing Societies.
Raj Neta jo hai dheere dheere janta se katta chala ja raha hai.
This campaign has revealed that the politicians are slowly losing touch with the public. They're no longer aware of the people's aspirations. In different local areas, people boycotted the elections. Why? Because they didn't have roads, drinking water, and sanitation. These are the national problems. It's not just about terrorism and foreign policy. These are the issues that connect the voters with the politicians. People are now keenly aware and are watching these issues of governance.
With the end of polling, the three major alliances, the NDA, the UPA, and the Third Front, led by the opposition BJP, the ruling Congress Party, and the left respectively, are now busy negotiating with smaller parties for possible power sharing. Most of the analysts predict a hung verdict, which means the regional parties will hold the balance of power. Nirja Chaudhary is a political analyst.
I think they will have the numbers also. Last time also they had just under half the number. This time also I think they will do well. What is also happening is the regional parties are becoming more assertive and more demanding of their pound of flesh. And this is being stated already before elections. So all these regional players will demand, you know, put their conditions and be much more strident.
At the moment, most of the regional parties are camping with the left in the Third Front. But whether the left will be able to keep its flock together will become clear on May 16th, when the election results will show who stands where. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
A drug called Naloxone, trade name Narcan, has proven effective when used by emergency medical personnel to reverse drug overdoses from opiates like heroin. More recently, efforts in several cities to get the remedy into the hands of those most likely to need it, that is, friends and family members of drug users, has saved lives. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, Connecticut.
A mother from suburban Hartford shared a harrowing story about her drug-addicted son.
I'm so terrified and traumatized, I can't even tell you. I mean, right under our noses, he almost died.
But this mother, who requested anonymity to protect her son's privacy, was able to save his life. She found him unconscious in his bedroom one evening in April. He had earlier admitted a heroin addiction and recently returned from a treatment program, but he had a relapse and injected himself with heroin.
He was not breathing, and he was gray. That's when I called 911 and went running around the house trying to find my Narcan. We gave Michael two injections to get him breathing again before the ambulance got to our house.
Michael is back in treatment. His mom had received her Narcan through a program that trains individuals to administer it outside of an emergency setting, most often in private homes or apartments. Dr. Doug Bruce is the medical director of a drug rehab facility in New Haven. He says he's never heard of any other physician in Connecticut who prescribes Narcan for use outside of a medical setting.
Narcan's very, very safe, and it's something that really all the clinics should do, primary care can do. It's the logical progression of believing that our patients are capable of providing some level of service with a very safe medication, and that it can save someone's life and then bring them into treatment.
But not all agree. Bertha Madras was the deputy drug czar under President George W. Bush. She says only trained medical personnel should administer naloxone.
They should be able to monitor cardiac function, and they are trained to do that. They're also trained to ensure that the person is awake and stable and to bring them to an emergency department once they are revived.
But many who use illegal drugs are afraid to call for help in an emergency, fearing arrest. For example, in March, a Louisiana man was charged with negligent homicide when he abandoned his companion who had overdosed on heroin and later died. Dr. Bruce says it's critical to take a person to a hospital right after a Narcan injection because the effect of the Narcan could wear off before the effect of the opioid and send the person back into overdose. He adds that Narcan is not divertible, meaning it has no street value because it can't make a person high. He says it's so safe that if it were given by mistake to a person who's not suffering from an opioid-related overdose, it would have no effect at all. New Havener Mark Kinsley is a trainer for the National Harm Reduction Coalition, based in New York City. He teaches laypersons around the country how to give naloxone to reverse overdoses.
You know, opiate addiction has changed. You know, we always had that mindset of the, you know, the guy who's strung out in the street with a needle sticking out of his arm. And the reality of it is that the fastest growing population is certainly white, middle-class, suburban kids that are now finding opiates very, very, very attractive.
As doctors have been more willing to prescribe pain medication for their patients, pain pills have become ubiquitous, and many adults are unaware of the danger the drugs pose sitting in the medicine cabinet. Kinsley says that's the easiest way for kids to get their drugs. They don't have to go to the street until their home supply runs out, and that's when they turn to street narcotics. Kinsley knows the power of naloxone from personal experience. He said after being in recovery from heroin addiction for 11 years, in 2004 he had a relapse. After he took the heroin, he went into overdose and stopped breathing. A friend who did trainings with him injected him with Narcan.
You know, once again, divine intervention had prevailed, and I had another shot at turning my life around. And, and have been dedicated to giving other people that same chance. I hope nobody ever has to use the stuff, but it certainly, saved my life, so I'm grateful for it.
While Narcan isn't easy to get in many places, Chicago has had success getting it into the hands of drug users and their friends and family members. The Chicago Recovery Alliance trained people to use it starting in 2001, and through April of this year has collected more than 1,000 self-reports of non-medical reversals. And from a high of 465 heroin-related deaths in 2000, data from the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office showed a 34% drop through 2007. Several other cities, including New York and Baltimore, also have successful programs. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe, Rose Katapchi, and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Abogado.